This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com. This is Dummy. It's Dummy the Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler. I'm back from my trip. I got to tell you guys, Greenpoint, Brooklyn, is not as nice as Siena, Italy. That's where I am. I'm in Greenpoint. The people I'm talking to here are David Goldblatt. He's in Bristol, England, not Connecticut. He's the author of The Ball is Round and Footyball Nation. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. And Danny Carbassian. Danny, you and I briefly crossed paths in New York. We didn't actually see each other, but you were here for the Arsenal game this weekend, which we're going to see. You're back in Miami, where you live. You remain, unless something crazy happened over the last few days, the only member of this podcast who has scored a goal for Arsenal. You're now a scout for the Gunners. How are you?
How's it going, man?
Good, good. I missed you guys last week. I want to thank Daniel Alarcon for filling in. He did a great job. I only heard part of that, to be honest, because I was trying not to pay attention to anything having to do with soccer. But now I'm back. The world of soccer is in a little bit of a lull, but we're not. We're going to talk about MLS. They've been pretty busy signing a bunch of new players and some old ones to new contracts. We're going to talk about that age-old question I guess we've been asking forever. Is MLS a retirement league? Is it something in between, a destination league? You know, who knows? It's kind of a weird... I'd love to get, David, your take on this, because you sort of have a global view about how leagues develop and how they change over time. We're also going to talk about some of the transfers that have happened over the last couple weeks. We're also going to talk about the summer tours happening in the U.S. right now. There are a bunch of European teams here to play against each other and against American teams. Finally, we are extremely excited to be joined by El Matador himself, Gabriel Luna, star of the new show Matador on the El Rey Network. He's going to talk about his show. It's apparently a spy show with a soccer theme. So I'm actually really interested in hearing that too. I haven't spoken to him. That was a guy named Ryan Catanese who spoke to him. But let's start with the big name coming to New York City, Frank Lampard. The big deal here, guys, if you read the New York Post, which I assume you don't, is, you know, they've revived this 13-year-old thing about Frank Lampard and some of his Chelsea teammates drunkenly making fun of 9/11 victims in, I guess it was Heathrow, the night of 9/11, 2001. David, do you remember any? I mean, like, I'm sort of at a loss about what to think about this, because obviously it's sort of despicable to do that. It happened 13 years ago. The Post is notoriously a muckraking type of paper, you know.
Yeah, welcome to New York is what it sounds like. I didn't actually know this story, and I'm a bit sort of shocked and surprised. And to be honest, you know, when 9/11 happened, Frank Lampard really was the last thing on my mind. I mean, right. So I don't know the details, so it's hard to, you know, it's hard to comment. But yeah, it's 13 years later. He's coming to New York. It can't be denied. He needs to say something, to say sorry. You know, he's a grown man now. And I think then we can just, I hope we can all just move on.
Yeah, he did a little interview with the Post actually saying, you know, it was sort of misreported and I shouldn't have been out that night, whatever. You know, what I think is kind of interesting about this is that he's, you know, a lot of the English European superstars that come over here do so in I think in no small part because they want to get away from the media scrutiny. And here's the New York Post, which is sort of the most tabloidy of the American papers, the most like those English, like the Sun and all those tabloids. And now they're really giving it to him in the same way that I'm sure that the English papers would have.
Is this new? Reversed. I mean, have the tabloids in the United States gone for a foreign player in any way like this before.
No, I kind of love it though. Cause you know, the people who read the post, the stereotype is that they're, you know, they're working class, very American. You know, they always lead on the back page with the Yankees or the Giants. And so, you know, if they're getting a little dose of soccer, I think that's a good thing to be totally honest.
You must tell Frank next time you see him.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll appreciate that. Okay. So I guess we're still talking about this. Is MLS a retirement league? Is it a feeder league? Danny, take us through, sort of step back for a second. Take us through what it means to be a feeder league. Like what is the trajectory of a player, a young player in a league that isn't one of the big five leagues, say in Europe, who comes up from his club team and wants to make a transfer there and then comes back? What is that career trajectory? Like how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, anytime you get the chance to get the opportunity to play in a first team, you know, wherever it is, you'll take it. But for feeder leagues, it's you come up, the leagues generally know that they aren't the, you know, the most competitive in the world, but they know they can offer a platform to get to these bigger leagues. And I think you see a lot of Americans going to Scandinavia as well as some of the other smaller leagues in Europe, like, you know, like Belgium even. We had a little bit there where we have some Americans over in Belgium playing playing regularly. And you know, those teams get the chance to play quite competitive football as well, and some of them go on to get into the Champions League where they get even more exposure. And then in terms of being feeder leagues and feeder clubs, you know, you impress over a couple of seasons, and then, you know, one of the bigger clubs or one of the maybe mid-table or smaller clubs from a bigger league will take a chance and bring you in on generally, you know, a little bit cheaper of a deal than it would be going into a much bigger team and trying to get a player. But I think you're seeing it even a lot of people now, even in the Premier League, are starting to call. You know, Southampton's always traditionally sold players to bigger sides, and they have an excellent youth program that does develop players. But this year has been quite crazy in terms of everybody labeling Southampton as a feeder club because they seem to be just having a fire sale at the moment. But yeah, I mean, you come through the academy, you know, you make it into the first team, you do well over a couple seasons, and then you make your way over to a bigger team for a new challenge.
So just to cut in for a second, you know, Southampton is a good example. It's an interesting example because, you know, I think Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain came from there, Gareth mm-hmm. Bale.
Theo Walcott,
right. And so, you know, more than, you know, what we're really talking about here is an economic model, right? Mm-hmm. A team or a league deciding, okay, our model is going to not be to acquire the best players, which is obviously, say, a Real Madrid model, but it's going to be to sustain what we can do, our maybe more modest ambitions by being really good at scouting players. And I'm thinking of teams like Udinese is really good at this and Ajax. And Ajax is interesting because they made that shift from being one of those top teams to being more or less a feeder team to the top teams. How does a league, you know, because we have to think about MLS as a league rather than the individual teams, because most of the big economic decisions are made by the league because the league owns the contracts of the players. Is this a strategy that will get MLS into the league, you know, sort of into the conversation with the big leagues, or are they sort of choosing a smaller profile by being a league that buys, you know, older players, stars who are past their prime, and tries as well to keep their best young players in the league rather than sending them off to develop against, you know, obviously better competition?
You know, there's no autarky in global football anymore. I think it's very, very hard to develop a strategy that's going to work, which is about isolationism. So, you know, too much globalization can clearly be a bad thing, but you've just got to deal with that. I don't think there's any choice because, you know, that's where players, for reasons of glamour, travel, personal development and money, inevitably are going to gravitate to bigger leagues. And I can't see how you're going to start imposing labor restrictions on them. I also don't think it's the end of the world, you know, speaking as a Spurs supporter, to have a few stars past their prime occasionally. nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's part of the mix. I mean, I think one just sort of needs to be, you know, realistic here about MLS. It's trying to, you know, make the next leap under conditions of, you know, of globalization and global competition, both on the screen and for players in the labor market. And there's no escape from that. So I think the focus really has got to be on continuing to generate a really great stream of players coming through, making the very best of them both before they go, but also making the best of them when they come home. I mean, that's certainly, you know, Brazil, as the country that sends the most players overseas, has really failed, you know, to benefit from those who, you know, rightly for reasons of homesickness and family and whatever, want to come home and play, you know, four or five seasons at home. And there's a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge that is garnered by those players that certainly in Brazil is not exploited. Those guys are not breaking into the ranks of coaches or administrators. But in the US, I think you've got a different kind of approach to knowledge transfer, and there's something really good to be made of that.
Well, I think one interesting way that MLS has done a pretty good job is in scouting and acquiring players from the Caribbean, from Central America, from Northern South America, from Argentina. You look at a guy like Freddy Montero, right? Who, Danny, you're familiar with, who played for the Seattle Sounders, young Colombian player, and is now a very hot player for Sporting Lisbon. You know, and so we have, I think, you know, and as someone, you scout for Arsenal in this region, I think that MLS teams probably have a competitive advantage in that respect, because they play against those teams in the CONCACAF Champions League. They're just closer by. It's easier to get down there and take a look. And there are some, I think, from, you know, we definitely saw this at the World Cup. Look at Costa Rica. There's some talent in this region that I don't think European teams have a total handle on.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I also think like it has to be a kind of a blend of everything. I mean, MLS was given a blank slate some 20 odd years ago and started off. And I think what it's going to be, and David hit on this a little bit, but it's a blend of having those veteran players. It's a blend of having these kind of relative unknowns, as you say, coming through smaller countries that impress in Gold Cup. And then it's also having your homegrown guys come through. You know, when people say it's a retirement league, You see it sometimes where players come and then they kind of fizzle out after a year because they did think it was retirement. But I was at the Arsenal New York Red Bull game the other day, and Thierry Henry was still one of the best players on the pitch.
Yep.
Which, you know, he's class, and it doesn't just because he's 36 years old now doesn't mean that suddenly he's a bad player, you know, and just because he's enjoying himself living in New York, it doesn't mean that he's no longer competitive. He brings a host of experience to the dressing room, and having players like that, and even bringing Frank Lampard in, who's had 13 very successful seasons at Chelsea, bringing a Champions League winner and a guy that's played for England so many times, it'll help the young American kids who are also aspiring to go on and become greats themselves, but it also helps just everybody else in the dressing room, you know, continue improving and just bringing the league up to another standard. Having American guys stay, you know, also helps because Americans can look up to those guys and say, like, wow, this is a league where I don't have to leave in order to become a big name and make a lot of money and enjoy doing what I do. Like, I can stay here, and it only helps grow the sport.
And this is key, get a chance with the national team. I mean,
exactly. I think two of the two big things when you're talking about U.S. soccer are, one is growing and making the league better, and then one is improving our national team. And I think they work hand in hand, because just because you go to Europe doesn't necessarily mean that you're suddenly improving the national team either. I think a lot of people confuse that at times. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine over the weekend talking about this, because I said there are players that have played in Europe regularly over the past 3 or 4 years that didn't make the World Cup team, and they play at pretty good teams. You know, just because you're playing in Europe doesn't necessarily mean that you're vastly improved in what we have here in MLS. So naturally, I think you'll see players go and some players stay. It's just the nature of the beast. Some young kids will get the opportunity when they're 17, 16, 17, 18, and they'll get offered, you know, nice contracts by European teams, and they'll naturally go to Europe. Others, maybe they miss the boat, maybe they go to college and then come out and then develop a little bit later, and then they get the opportunity to go to Europe, but instead they've shown their loyalty to MLS and they continue growing the league here. And I think that's what Beisler and Graham Zuzzi have done, which is nice to see.
Yeah, and I think the other thing we should mention is that, you know, DeMarcus Beasley also signed with Houston. Jay DeMeritt is retiring. He's another guy who came back from playing in England. There's a lot less heartburn about Americans coming back and playing here, when they're a little older, which I think is a nice thing. David, you're right. For every Ronaldinho who goes back and plays in Brazil, there are a bunch of big stars who go on to play in the Middle East or Japan or something and never come back and sort of bring back anything that they've learned or give back, I guess, to the Brazilian league that formed them.
Sure. And, you know, the tragedy in Brazil is that those that do go back, not just on the pitch, but off the pitch, have not been able to make an impact, which is where Bom Senso, the protest movement amongst Brazilian footballers, which I note is actually back and active again as the league kicks off in Brazil. You know, it's those guys who are saying there are other ways of doing this. You know, they've seen another way of operating in professional football, and it would be really great to see those dudes get more of a place in Brazilian football and have more of an impact.
All right. Well, guys, that takes us to the end of that conversation. We're going to move on, but just for a second, I want to mention that the show has a new sponsor, Who Are You Designs. They have a great line of t-shirts for club teams, national teams. They even have a shirt with Clint Dempsey's mean face on it. If you head over there, you can use the promo code DUMMY to get a discount and free shipping. So go ahead and go over and check out their shirts. Up next, we're going to discuss the big European teams and some of the minor ones crisscrossing the U.S. right now on their summer tours. Okay, Danny, these tours, first of all, Louis van Gaal came out. He's pretty angry about this tour. He said they're going to rack up 13,000 miles or something like that, as they go from, what is it, LA to somewhere else, to Washington, D.C., to Ann Arbor. It's a big continent. These players aren't used to it. They're supposed to be relaxing, recuperating. Are these tours bad for, I mean, they're bad for players, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they're the best. They're definitely made with the sponsors in mind and the brand of the club in mind. With that said, it also does break up preseason nicely at times. I mean, you go back. A lot of people have failed to realize that the summer break is actually really, really short for footballers, and you'll get maybe a month and a half off, and you take 2 weeks where you're not doing anything, and then you're spending the next of the time, you know, getting prepared for preseason, so you don't come back out of shape. When you spend the first month and a half of preseason kind of going to the training ground every single day, it's a bit monotonous, just working on fitness, and you get the balls out a little bit later. It's nice to go somewhere. With that said, traveling across the world and stopping in multiple cities probably isn't the best for recuperation and actually preparing yourself for a season. And I think that's where Van Gaal has came out and said it's a bit much right now. And for us, it's nice. Arsenal, I just got back from New York, where Arsenal came for the first time on tour to the States, and it was great seeing first of all seeing the amount of support that was just there. One of the reasons, as you said, the clubs come is because these clubs are massive. They're global brands now, and they've realized that their fan bases aren't just in the one city or the one country where they reside. They're everywhere, and you know, truth of the matter is, most of these fans will likely never get the chance to go to the Emirates or Old Trafford or any of these other stadiums to watch their team. So coming to their own backyards to put the talent on display is pretty awesome. And I got to speak with a lot of the fans when I was there, and I mean, there were fans from literally everywhere, all across the United States. I mean, Seattle, Portland, LA, you know, Miami, obviously, all over New York, all over the Northeast. And it was just nice seeing all these people so excited, and half of them didn't even have tickets to the game. They just went for all the fan events just to kind of be there and be around it all, which was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I went, you know, I was getting back from JFK, the airport, around the time that the game was kicking off, and I took the train into Penn Station. I took the subway to a friend's house, and it was too late for these guys to make it to the game. So they must've been going somewhere else, but there were so many people wearing Arsenal jerseys. I was pointing it out to my wife. We had just had a pretty bad flight on Emirates. And she was, every time we saw the jersey, she was like, ugh. Anyway, I was really amazed by the number of people wearing Arsenal jerseys in the city that night. And I heard from some friends who went to the game that, they said it was like 90% Arsenal fans.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was wild. Henry was obviously the star of everything. You couldn't do anything wrong. If you know, if he messed up, the Arsenal fans would cheer, and if he did well, the Red Bull fans would cheer. So he was, they had a huge banner and everything for him. But yeah, on the Friday night, I mean, they basically rented out three bars. They didn't rent them out. There's Arsenal fans just everywhere. But on 14th Street, between 2nd and 3rd, there was just Arsenal fans all over these three bars. You couldn't get in. I went just for a little bit to say hello to a couple people. And you, I mean, it was slammed. And for like two straight streets, there was just all Arsenal shirts everywhere. And one event, actually, Henri was meant to show up at the Puma store that night, actually. And there was a line that was three blocks long. And they ended up canceling the event because of security issues. Like, they just weren't prepared for that. That volume of people to come, which is an Arsenal guy, you know, it's nice to see that happen. So, but yeah, it was a good weekend.
Well, so before the World Cup started, right before, I did a little story for Fortune about these tours and like them, you know, the economic reasons behind them and the marketing reasons. But you know, hearing about this and seeing this, and I know Arsenal is a special case because A, they're very popular here, and B, they haven't been here for a long time. So they probably had a boost in support from that and more people than usual. But there is an element of pure just enjoyment and wanting to be near their favorite team for these teams. So I don't know. I guess the cynic in me thinks, yeah, it's pretty, maybe it's exploitative to have these high ticket prices and these teams come over and play their B and C teams. But on the other hand, David, I there is, I guess, a nice element to this. It's not all greed and, you know.
Can I just say first just how incredibly weird it is in some ways for me? You know, I think about Arsenal in the 1970s and what an Arsenal game looked like, you know, in the 1980s, and what sort of Arsenal meant in the 1980s. And then you look at what's happening in New York the last couple of days. It is the most extraordinary transformation.
Well, I think most of our listeners, and you know, this is certainly true of me as well because of my age and whatever, we think of Arsenal as Arsene Wenger and ever since Arsene Wenger.
But, and you're just not thinking George Graham. You're not thinking boring, no. Boring Arsenal.
Can you describe what Arsenal meant back then, David?
Arsenal was rough. Arsenal was rough. It may have been in Islington, you know, which is now a very gentrified area of North London. But in the 1970s, yeah, it was rough working class North London. I mean, it had its middle class base as well. You know, and it was long hair and flared trousers and bother boots and the rest of it. And the team itself were just notorious for being, you know, rough and tedious under George Graham, and always sneaking a 1-0 win at the last minute when they didn't deserve it. And all across, you know, the land, you'd hear crowds singing boring, boring Arsenal, which is, you know, they get a lot of stick these days, but nobody sings that anymore. So the idea that it would be a global brand that, you know, between 2nd and 3rd on 14th Street, you know, I mean, that's testament to a lot of social and a lot of sporting change.
Well, it's also technology. I mean, making it easy. You know, I think Arsenal's most glorious period came at a time when the TV contracts had exploded. It was easier than ever to sort of become a fan and access the games.
They were great. Yeah, no, it was a good, you know, they were there at a really good moment. And, you know, that's also true. I mean, my sense, you know, walking around New York or Los Angeles, or just like my students in my football class is, you know, there's a lot of Arsenal is almost feels like the most. I mean, maybe that's not so. You know, there's a certain amount of Chelsea, Manchester United and Liverpool. And then for the kind of the oddballs and the quirky who want to stand us to slightly to one side, I find there's quite a few Everton and Tottenham characters around. And that seems to be, you know, be the mix. But yeah, they all, and just to go back to your question, I mean, I really feel for the players because I think it is like, oh, just like, you know, you've got to do the pre for pre-season and then the pre-season tour as well. I think it's sweet. You know, it's nice. People love Arsenal. They want to watch some great football. Bless them. You know, how can that be? I can't get too cynical about it. To be honest, I think it is harsher, and it's so much flying as well. And I think that's pretty tough. That's pretty tough too on everybody, and pretty tough on the planet.
Well, maybe the next step is an NFL style, you know, they play a game or two in London every year. Maybe
that was explored though. The Premier League wanted to introduce the 39th game, as it was called. This is like 2009, 2010, where every Premier League team would play one game overseas against an opponent, possibly all on the same sort of weekend at some point in the season. And cities around the world would have been given the opportunity to bid to host those. And very rarely, actually, in English football over the last 20 years, something that the Premier League very much wanted to do was shouted down by every other football association and league in the world, not to mention fans, so on and so forth. And I think having recognised that that option just will not play, they've ramped the tour thing up.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Thanks, guys. Okay, it's time for another quick break. Stay where you are. Our reporter Ryan Katniss caught up with Gabriel Luna to talk about his starring role on the El Rey Network's new soccer-themed spy show, Matador. This is going to be great.
The LA Riot are having open tryouts.
Try out for a professional soccer team? I'm going to need a sample of whatever you two are smoking.
The gig is just a cover.
Are you in?
I've got another situation.
You're not there to babysit, Bravo. Finish the job. Bravo.
Gabriel, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Good morning, Ryan.
Obviously, it's still a very new show. For people who haven't seen it, give me a little TV guide version of what the show is about.
Yeah, no, I play Tony Matador Bravo. Well, he's just Tony Bravo until he earns the moniker. But I'm a DEA agent from East LA who is recruited by the CIA to infiltrate the Los Angeles Riot, which is the professional soccer team in LA. The owner, played by Alfred Molina, is the target, and so they need someone on the inside. During a conflict at the tryout with a guy nicknamed the Bull, I earned the nickname Matador, and the story kind of continues from there.
As his CIA objective when he gets recruited by the CIA is to infiltrate this team, and he has to make the team. He has to join a tryout. How difficult was that for you? Did you play soccer in high school or anything like that?
I played in college in a couple of rec leagues and played some turbo indoor stuff throughout. But no, before that, I was primarily an American football player, played strong safety, and was a small forward on the basketball team. But no, football, I started playing just for fun with my friends in college. It's actually kind of great. My alma mater just sent me a jersey.
Did that have a Bravo name or a Luna name on the back?
They asked me, and I went with Luna. I just wanted to personalize it a little bit. It was cool, man. And then, in the show, of course, yeah, there's the tryout, and that is the primary objective. The CIA now has a mole for the entire season because I make the team due to this video of this fight that I have with the Bull going viral. And Fred's character, Andres Galan, starts to see dollar signs and offers me a contract. So I'm there for the season. They have someone on the team, and that kind of sets the stage for the events in our show.
Now, the show is primarily kind of a spy show, but there's plenty of kind of soccer action in it. Can you explain kind of the process behind that? Are you out there playing yourself, or is there kind of a double?
Yeah, no. So the training began a couple weeks before the show started. I began my physical training, before I even had the part, just because I was quite aware of the endurance and the health and the fitness required to be a footballer, even to pretend to be. I just, I just did a lot of agility training and sprints and footwork, try to tighten up my skills. And as we began to shoot it, the pilot was really football heavy and soccer heavy. And we were out there in the valley. I think it was like 97 degrees and everyone's complaining. And I smile and I go and I pat everyone on the back. And I'm like, come on, this is a nice fall day in Austin, Texas.
Yeah. A little background. Gabriel, is from Austin. I'm actually talking to him from Austin, where it is currently about 103 degrees, so he has plenty of experience with hot weather.
Yeah, so there we were in Van Nuys running around, and I'm taking a lot of knocks, you know, and I'm just flying all over the place. This guy named Devin plays Greg Zupan, the bull, the aforementioned bull. And yeah, just getting thrown around, man, making a bunch of runs, and they call cut, and you trot back to one, and you got to make that run again. You know, it's not doing it for 90 minutes. It's doing it for a full day, 12 to 15-hour day. So it's tough, but it's fun, and we get to go out there, and we have a lot of support. Game Changing Films does the soccer coordination, and they've hired just slew of professionals who've come in, and guys who've done their time in the MLS. And we got Chris Shafi. All these guys played for FC Dallas, LA Galaxy, Real Salt Lake. And, you know, a lot of these guys have some experience. And but for the most part, it's me out there. Like, occasionally I have a great, great soccer double named Josh who has the third fastest recorded shot in the MLS combine, which I think is like 67 miles per hour. Kelly is his name, Chess. Josh Kelly. Really nice guy, but my goal is to have him work as little as possible. So I continue to train each week. I do maybe 1 or 2 hour sessions whenever I can fit it in the shooting schedule.
Like I said before, you're from Austin, and the director of the show and the, I guess, the guy behind the whole El Rey network is Robert Rodriguez, who has obviously big ties around here. What was it initially that drew you to this show and this character, and, you know, What's it like working with Robert?
Well, I came across a breakdown for this character, this show, about a year ago. And I suppose what drew me to it was the fact that it was, it was a young, put-together hero, a good guy of Latin American descent, and American being the key word. They described it as a James Bond-type character, which is obviously a fantasy of most men to have this, you know, live in this high-profile world and bed beautiful women and run around, you know, taking out the bad guys. So I think anybody would be interested. So I did everything in my power to get in that room. And once I did, it was like breathing, man. The character myself, there's just really uncanny parallels. But Robert is amazing, man. Robert's the Miles Davis in movies, dude. He's just the coolest dude. He likes to just go. You know, that's his thing. He has it all in his head, and it doesn't take a lot of pre-production. I love him. He's been a hero of mine forever. I mean, he's Robert Rodriguez.
Something that you kind of mentioned, the idea of a young Latino hero, when you get a lot of these kind of spy espionage type things, the Latino guy is usually the drug lord.
Right.
He's the bad guy. And so, you know, did you realize that when you first saw this script or saw this idea, or did that kind of slowly dawn on you, like, hey, this is like role reversal in a good way?
You know, when we got to the end of the auditioning process, I sat there. I started to count on my fingers and tried to think and rack my brain for American-born Latin American leads, you know, young in this age range. And the more I tried, the more frustrated it became to realize that I couldn't, on one hand, count. I was very aware of the fact that we are disproportionately represented in a negative way. And this was something that, this is something that I'd be proud of, because it's completely unhealthy for children to look to the screen to see themselves and their peers and at school and all around the streets, but then to look to the screen and be absent, an image of themselves completely absent from the media. You know, I just, to be that is a great honor, and one that I don't take lightly. And when I sat in front of John Fogelman, he's a CEO of Factory Made and one of the co-founders of our network, he sat there, shook my hand, looked me in the eye, and he asked me if I was prepared to accept a responsibility greater than being a guy on a TV show. I told him, yes, sir, I am. Because I realized that, you know, months before when the project was in its infancy, that this would be an important thing in the overall media environment.
Sure. Before we wrap things up, I do want to take this back onto the field. Not Tony Bravo, but Gabriel Luna. Who does he root for on the soccer field? What's your favorite team? Do you have any favorite players?
I used to root Liverpool. But I followed Messi since he was 15, so I've always been a huge Messi fan. So, and it's easy to root for Barca, but I had to. And I love the way Piqué plays in the back line. I love Pujol, and I love all those guys. Xavi is just amazing. He's incredible. And they're hard not to love. At the World Cup, I was pulling for Mexico. I mean, they're a tournament team, and they really come to play. And so I love Gio. Gio's probably my favorite player. Then, I guess, of course, the United States. I thought they performed well. I thought Jermaine Jones was fantastic. Beyond that, I started rooting for Colombia. I thought they were playing beautifully. Cuadrado he's just got such flash, you know, he's so good.
Sure, yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with you there. So real quick, for people who don't have El Rey, is there a way for them to access the show?
I believe we may be on Dish. I'm not sure exactly, but I know for a fact we're on DirecTV and Time Warner. But if you don't, you can always order the entire season on iTunes. I believe it's on Amazon. Folks with an Xbox One, it's available there. So, I mean, there are other channels.
So it comes on Tuesday nights, right? 9:30 Eastern?
Yes, sir.
And if you haven't caught it yet, it's just a fun show, just kind of a popcorn summer exciting show, and there's definitely some humor in it. Well, Gabriel Luna, thank you so much for joining us on Dummy.
Thank you, Ryan.
All right, it's just about time to wrap things up. Before we do, let's do our Tiki Talka segment. Well, guys, I'm going to go first. I have something that I think is kind of great. So because Howler was funded on Kickstarter, I get a lot of emails and notes from other Kickstarter soccer project starters. And one that I got this week is from these guys in Montana who have a project that they're calling Legend Soccer Company, the Bamboo Shin Guard. And they want to make shin guards out of bamboo. And the reason I like this, I don't know if I would ever wear these, but it's sort of like locavore, you know, conscientious about the environment meets steampunk. You got to see the design aesthetic on these. And it's kind of great. I mean, you know, soccer is sort of immune from this.
Fill us in on that, George, the steampunk decoration on the bamboo there. You gotta give me more.
Yeah, okay, so first of all, the logo appears to be branded into the bamboo. So instead of like it's literally burned in. And every pair of these shin guards ships in a wooden box for safekeeping. It literally says a pair of Squire shin guards comes with a, they're called the Squire shin guards, by the way. A pair of Squire shin guards comes with a pair of black sleeves that keeps Squire in place and comes in a beautiful wooden box for safekeeping. Pretty fancy. So anyway,
can I ask a question, George?
Yes.
Like if you get kicked hard in the leg and you're wearing wooden shin guards.
Right.
These
are bamboo. These are bamboo. And so I don't know if they splinter. That's probably something you want to find out.
before you make the purchase.
Before you purchase. Don't wear the box. Just from being a player for many years, I know how bad this stuff starts to smell. And I don't know if a wooden box, if that smell is going to come out of there. But anyway, at your own risk, I'm not endorsing, nor am I making fun of these shin guards. I just think it's an interesting idea. They're on Kickstarter. Okay, Danny, what you got?
I'm gonna go. I'm unfortunately not the happiest of stories this week, but in a time, and we spoke about this just now, but in a time where, you know, TV rights and sponsorships and all are paying so much money, and clubs are making so much money, and players as well. I guess this month it was sad to see AS Caen, the French team that produced Zidane, Vieira, and even Gal Clichy. I guess they filed for bankruptcy, and then they were told that they can no longer exist as a professional football club because of their debts, which is really sad, in my opinion, because Zidane is probably my favorite player ever. And they've, you know, for a club, for a French club that has produced guys like Vieira and Zidane, and even Clichy signed from there. Clichy and I signed at Arsenal the same year, and he came from Caen. And as a 17-year-old kid, I didn't particularly know much about French football or, you know, French geography. So when he kept saying he was from Caen, I didn't particularly know where he was from, if it wasn't Paris or somewhere else. But yeah, I just think it's a shame, really, you know, that there's these, you know, in a time where so much focus is on these big clubs making all this money and Forbes putting out a list of saying how rich some of these clubs are, that there's still clubs that need only maybe a couple million pounds or euros to keep going, and they're unable to get it, and then they have to close their doors, which I thought was quite sad.
I think we'll have to have another episode where we talk about that, the starry state of finances of the teams that aren't the biggest clubs, and even the sorry finances of the biggest clubs. David,
yeah,
I'm sure you'll
have
a lot to talk
about. They're the sorriest of all. Have you seen Manchester City's balance sheet recently?
Well, they can afford it, I guess. David, What do you have?
Well, as I said last week, I'm doing my absolute level best not to concentrate on football for a week or two. But it came back into my life this week when, amazingly, someone actually returned a DVD to me that I'd lent them, which I find is a very rare experience in this world. And it's a brilliant set of three films made in Brazil in the late 80s and early 90s. The series is called Futebol, and the director is João Maria Salles, who went on to create a magazine called Piauí, which is the kind of most interesting critical voice in the whole of the Brazilian media. And these are three sensational low-key documentaries about the reality of the Brazilian player labour market and what it's really like and how it really works. And the third one, which I watched a little clip of earlier, is my favourite, about Paulo César, who was one of the 1970 team and a great flamboyant star of the era, who was marginalised precisely for that reason by the authoritarian powers of the time. And we join him in Rio in the late 1980s and early 1990s, kind of having to hustle at society football games and make appearances to keep the show on the road. And it's a really sweet and incredibly human and beautifully observed movie.
Okay. Can you tell us the name of the filmmaker again?
It is João Moreira Salles, and that's spelled S-A-L-L-E-S.
Okay, so we'll have a link to whatever we can find about that. I'm not even sure it's on YouTube, but if we can find it, we will put a link to it on the show page. Guys, that does it for this episode of Dummy. Really great talking to you after a week missing. I want to thank our special guest, Gabriel Luna, for joining us on the show. Thanks to you guys, David Goldblatt, Denny Carbassian, for bringing your insight again this week. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They are members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. Make sure you subscribe to our show in iTunes if you haven't yet, or whatever podcast app you use. And leave a comment or a rating. It really helps us get new listeners, so we would appreciate that. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We are at What a Howler. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson with help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deppenbrock, and Malena Barajas. I'm George Qureshi, and I'll be back next week with the rest of these dummies. We'll see you soon.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com.